Jennifer Zamparelli on 2FM.
Sponsored by Virgin Mobile. We'll tell you when your phone is paid off. Virgin Mobile. Bring on amazing.
Sleep is hard to get these days. Oh, it is. And that could be whether you're working shifts or you're looking at screens too much, whether we've had too much caffeine or not enough exercise. It seems, I'm sure you can agree, everyone wants better sleep. But how did we get here? How did this basic human function become so complicated? Well, Professor Russell Foster is a professor of circadian neuroscience, and his new book, Lifetime, The New Science of the Body Clock and How It Can Revolutionize Your Sleep, hopes to get people back to basics when it comes to sleep. He is on the line. Russell, how are you doing?
Good morning. I'm very well indeed, Jennifer. Great to talk to you.
And to you. Let's first look at something we might not even think about. Can I ask you, why was the invention of the light bulb a much more problematic invention than we might think?
Well, you know, we are an animal that has evolved to be essentially active during the day and asleep at night. And from the 1950s onwards, you know, with cheap, safe electric lighting, we really wholesale sort of invaded the night. And because we could invade the night, we kind of abandoned one of the most important parts of our biology, which is our sleep. And I think without really thinking about it, without realizing, we've thrown away such an important part of what, you know, what makes us what we are. I mean, if you think about it, you know, so much of our ability to function during the day is defined by the quality of the sleep at night. And yet, you know, we kind of marginalized it. And I think it's now time that we, you know, embrace that part of our biology once again and sort of give it a bit of a cuddle.
Yes, hear, hear. I'm all for it. I'm here for it, Russell. What is circadian neuroscience then?
So, and it's really what I study, which is that we have an internal body clock, an internal representation of the day. And what it does is fine-tune essentially every aspect of our physiology and behavior to the varied and predictable demands of the rest activity cycle. So, for example, during the day, you know, we need to be active, so core body temperature is up. We need to sort of have the ability to run and fight, so cortisol levels sort of rise. At night, for example, we undergo tissue repair, so growth hormone is produced. So it's this incredible sort of regulator. If you think about it, you know, for our bodies to function, we need the right materials delivered to the correct tissues and organs at the right concentration at the optimum time of day. And this sort of exquisite coordination in time and space is provided by the circadian system with the body clock. And without it, you know, our growth, metabolism, memory formation, decision making, protection from infection, all that kind of stuff falls apart. So it really is central to our lives. And you know, part of the reason for writing the book Lifetime was because I was fed up with the sort of the sergeant majors of sleep sort of screaming, you must do this and you must do that. You must get 8 hours. You shouldn't look at a Kindle before you go to bed. And so really wanted to sort of unpack the science of the body clock, circadian rhythms, mm-hmm. and based on the science, provide guidance regarding how this knowledge can genuinely improve our health and our well-being.
Okay.
And the key thing is, of course, we are, it's like shoe size, you know, sleep is like shoe size, not one size fits all. And we've got to find out for ourselves what we need and then defend those behaviors.
Aha. Okay. So we don't all need 8 hours sleep. Is that what you're telling me?
I'm telling you that. That's an average. But, you know, it's again, you wouldn't make everybody wear the same shoe size.
Yeah.
And in the same way, insisting that everybody should get 8 hours. And it causes huge anxiety. I mean, you know, one chap came up to me and said, I don't get 8 hours of sleep. Am I going to die? And I said, well, yeah, you're going to die. But it's not necessarily because you're not getting 8 hours of sleep. I mean, you know, for adults, it can range from 6 to 10, 10 and a half, even 11 hours. And that's the healthy range. Below 6, I'd begin to get a bit concerned. And above 10 and a half, I'd worry a bit. But, you know, it's a huge range. And we've got to decide for ourselves what we need.
How do we do
well,
that?
Well, do you know, that's the simple bit. I mean, first of all, is if you're able to function optimally during the day, then you're probably getting the sleep that you need at night. If you're dependent upon an alarm clock or another person to get you out of bed, you're not getting enough sleep. Same is if you oversleep extensively on free days, such as the weekends or holidays. If you take a long time to wake up, if you're sort of kind of groggy for a long time, if you feel sleepy, irritable and fatigued when you are awake, if you crave a nap during the day, if you find yourself doing stupid and unreflective, overly impulsive things, and also if you're craving caffeinated and sugar-rich drinks, then these are all signs you're not getting enough sleep. But also, you've got to listen to your friends, family and work colleagues. And if they say, you know, you're a bit more irritable, you're not quite so empathetic, you seem to be doing, you know, a bit more disinhibited, stupid things, then you need to listen to these individuals because these are all signs you're not getting the sleep that you need. Principle one is, you know, are you able to function optimally during the day, and do you oversleep on free days?
Okay.
That's the classic one.
Okay, amazing. Okay, let's talk about night shifts because night shifts have an impact on our health and our lives, and it's pretty scary when you read some of the impacts. But if you work night shift, a lot of our listeners do, can you do anything to protect yourself?
Yeah, I think this is a really, really important point because we're not going to put the 24/7 society back in its bottle. You know, it would be naive to say you shouldn't do night shift. Lots of people have to, and of course, our frontline staff, like our nurses, our doctors, and our police, we need those people on the night shift. So knowing, though, you're at greater risk of, let's say, coronary heart disease, diabetes 2, and even cancer, then why haven't we instituted higher frequency health checks in our night shift workers to make sure that these conditions don't get out of hand? You know, they don't become really bad before we can do something about it. I think a really low hanging fruit is that knowing that, you know, obesity, type 2 diabetes is much higher on the night shift, then why don't we provide the appropriate nutrition? What's available to night shift workers? It's fast food, high fat, high sugar, and we should be providing easy to digest protein snacks. And, you know, it's not beyond the wit of humanity to develop those sorts of foods. You know, there's a study published a few years ago showing that in the UK, 57% of junior doctors after the night shift had either had a crash or a near miss on the drive home. So why aren't we providing advice about the use of apps, you know, to that you can put on your phone that will detect if your head is nodding or the car is moving laterally, setting off alarm to wake you up. Another really important area is the sort of impact it has on the family and the people you live with. So one study from the States showed that the divorce rate for some sectors in doing night shift work is 6 times higher than the same job on the day shift. So we should be providing education for not only the workforce, but also the people they live with, explaining, look, this your loved partner hasn't turned into a monster, but this is part of the consequences of driving your biology outside of its normal range. So there are lots of things that we could do now that we're not doing. And I think that's, we need to generate greater awareness in our governments and you know, by employers for their employees. I think there's a real duty of care that we could start to work on here. And you know, a lot of it is ignorance. I mean, a policeman in the UK contacted me because one of his best friends had completed a night shift, was driving home, crashed his car into a tree and was killed. And he was saying, look, we don't get any advice about the danger of driving after night shift. And it's sort of simple educational pieces for our key workers.
Absolutely. We had this very conversation. We had a huge conversation about night shifts. And very sadly, we lost a nurse in Donegal after night shift. And then we had another nurse on the phone talking about after working a double shift and a night shift, she had a near miss and crashed the car. So that is so important. Yeah. What about naps? Are naps for anybody a good idea?
Well, it's a little bit complicated, but the rule of thumb is, well, first of all, if you need a nap, you're probably not getting the optimum sleep at night. So that's sort of an indication. But a 20-minute nap Not too late in the day is probably fine. So, you know, a nap around early afternoon can actually make you more efficient for the second part of the day. The nap shouldn't be longer than 20 minutes. If it's longer, you can dive into deeper sleep. And so, you know, waking up from that deep sleep can make you sluggish and it can be completely counterproductive. Where naps, you have to be careful. And this is, you know, we've done some studies on teenagers in this regard. So teenagers, they are programmed biologically to go to bed later and get up later, and we can talk about the reasons for that. So there's a tendency to go to sleep later, but combined with things like social media and all the rest of it, then nighttime sleep can be really short. They're driven out of bed to get to school, they struggle through school, and then they get home, and then they take a two-hour sleep, which is not really a nap. Now, that big, you know, sleep before bed, late in the day, before bed, drives back the pressure to go to sleep. So it's more difficult because you've had that nap in the late afternoon. It's more difficult to get to sleep that night. So pushing back the sleep pressure combined with a later body clock, combined with social media, means that our teenagers can get very short nighttime sleep, struggle through the school day, and then, of course, need longer and longer naps. And you can fall into a really vicious cycle of shorter nighttime sleep and longer naps. And that's what really must be avoided. And, you know, teenagers should be, you know, the recommendation would be try not to have that nap and certainly don't have it close to bedtime.
Okay, but 20 minutes is the optimal time, which I hope answers our text in, because we have someone texting in. They work in aviation, night shifts, earlies, different time zones, and they said, I end up having 3 to 4 hour naps every day, which makes me not sleep at night. There we go. You answer that. So 20 minutes is the optimal time.
Ideally, 20 minutes, not too close to bedtime. And that's fine. And of course, the elderly also fall into sort of the need for an afternoon nap, and that can be complicated because of sometimes medication. Certainly, in the nursing home environment, there's the use of sedatives, and these most clinicians would now strongly recommend that you did not dose up our elderly with sedatives, because it can massively disrupt sleep, and of course it can cause daytime tiredness, nighttime falls, and endless napping. So it's really good to try and break the habit.
Okay, interesting. Now this is incredible. Is it true that if you're trying to conceive, morning is better?
Well,
but this ties into everything we're talking about today. We're talking about relationships and sexual relationships. But is this true?
There is some. Actually, I mentioned this on a radio program in the UK, and I was saying that, biology is very dynamic. So, for example, testosterone, you know, peaks in the morning, and that's when sperm are most motile. So, you know, that might be a good time to try and conceive. And anyway, I sort of gave this bit of information, and then 2 months later, it was in fact from a doctor and his wife saying, "Oh, just wanted to let you know, we've been trying to conceive for 2 years, and the first time we did it in the morning, it worked. So thanks very much indeed." And I know it's hilarious; it's an NF1, but seriously, sperm motility is higher at that time of day. There's lots of factors associated with fertility, of course, but it may be one of the important factors. Yeah. While we're talking about sort of conception, the female menstrual cycle, you know, every aspect of it is being fine-tuned by a circadian clock. So the release of the hormones from the pituitary gland, the response to those hormones by the ovary, are all sort of being coordinated to produce this sort of extraordinary set of hormonal changes associated with ovulation and the chances of, you know, releasing an egg and conception, which is why, of course, you see lower levels of fertility. And in fact, there's even some evidence of a higher rate of spontaneous abortion in night shift workers. And there's some very interesting studies on air crew showing that, menstrual cycle lengths can be all over the place and real difficulty in conception. So, you know, if you are sort of trying to conceive, then lots of long haul flights and night shift work
not great.
May well be a problem.
Professor, lastly, can I ask you, what are the main things you need to look at if you just want to improve your sleep?
Okay. Well, first of all, we've talked about this. Define what works for you. You know, really say, how much sleep do I need and what's my sleep timing? Because, you know, we all have different chronotypes, whether we're a morning type or an evening type. So work that out. And in fact, there's a questionnaire at the end of Lifetime that you might want to look at. Also, look after your clock. So get morning light to set the clock, which then sets the sleep-wake cycle. So regularity is really important. When you eat, when you exercise is also good. Most people don't have a sleep problem. They have a stress or an anxiety issue. So whatever it takes, you know, after work, try and de-stress, whether it's, you know, mindfulness or exercise or whatever. Don't sedate yourself. So many people will, you know, fall into a cycle of using alcohol to wind down in the evening to try and relax. That can massively disrupt sleep. And in fact, some of the important things going on in the brain whilst we sleep, so memory consolidation, the processing of information. And of course, what happens is you get, you know, sedative-induced sort of rest. Well, it's not rest. It's sort of some form of sleep. But then you wake, and then you need stimulants to drive the waking day. So you can fall into this sedative-stimulant feedback loop. The other thing I would say is, and I know it's been difficult during lockdown, but try and make the bedroom a sort of a haven, a place for sleep, and perhaps one or two other things, but remove devices, you know, keep the lights low, invest in good mattresses, pillows, duvets, and you know, it should be this wonderful haven that you sort of can relax in, and that's what you associate with sleep. So there are some of the key points that I would say. But one final thing, which is a bit of a bugbear of mine, don't take apps too seriously. Sleep apps can be useful in telling you roughly when you went to bed and when you woke up and if you woke up in the night. But if they start to tell you, oh, you've had a good night's sleep, or you've got lots of REM sleep and lots of slow wave sleep, you ignore it, because they simply can't be accurate enough to tell you that sort of thing. And people get amazingly anxious about it. One chap spoke to me and said, I'm worried I'm not getting any slow wave sleep. And I said, well, how do you know? He said, well, my apps tell you me. I said, well, the apps are probably wrong. And he said, oh, I'm not so sure about that. And I'm so anxious about it. I wake myself at 3 o'clock in the morning with an alarm clock to check how much slow wave sleep I've had. You know, people can get terribly anxious.
Yeah, because the apps are wrong when it comes to Tinder. I'm sure they're wrong when it comes to these sleep apps as well. You know what I mean? Professor Russell Foster, thank you so much. Such an interesting chat. But your book, Lifetime, The New Signs of the Body Clock and How It Can Revolutionise Your Sleep and Health, is published by Penguin. It's available now. I'm pretty sure every person who works night shifts or just wants to improve their sleep is running to get this book now. There's some really fascinating stuff in there. And thank you for joining us on the show today. Take care.
Been a great pleasure, Jennifer. Hopefully we'll speak again.
Absolutely.
Take care.
Bye-bye. Loved it. And get him on for Newsybits. We loved him. Just amazing. I love that chat. Really, really interesting stuff. Again, the book is called Lifetime, The New Signs of the Body Clock and How It Can Revolutionise Your Sleep and Health, by Russell Foster. Go and get it. We'll be back.
Jennifer Zamparelli on 2FM.